From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Megan Mack. Our connection this hour will be made in November when voters go to the polls to elect members of city council, members of school and town boards, county executives, and more. All throughout each election season, we welcome candidates for office to come on the show to discuss their views and ideas. We don't discriminate. If you're on the ballot, you have time on this program. We've heard from candidates throughout the recent primary season, Democrats and Republicans who have campaigned for a range of local offices. President Calvin Coolidge once said, quote, "What we need is not more federal government, but better local government," end quote. And yet most Americans sit their local elections out. Well, this hour, it's a chance to hear from some of the candidates for a local office, Rochester City Council, that we haven't heard from yet in this cycle. They join me this hour to share their platforms, their priorities, and the changes they would like to see in Rochester. Plus, they'll take your questions. Joining me in studio is Alex White, the Green Party candidate in the South District. Welcome back to you, Alex.
Thanks for having me.
Chris Eades is a Green Party candidate in the Northeast District. Welcome to you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Dave Sutliffadius is a Green Party candidate in the East District.
I am. Hi.
Welcome to you.
Thanks.
And later this hour, we'll be joined by Marcus Williams, the Republican candidate in the South District. We did invite the Working Families Party candidate, Vijaya Kadaka, but he was unavailable to join us, so we've offered him separate time on this program in the near future. So I'd like to talk to all of our guests about why they're running. I'll remind you, listeners, you can join this conversation by calling 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You can email your questions and comments to connections@WXXI.org. And you can find me on Twitter at MMacMedia. So we'll just go around the table. We'll ask each candidate to tell us a little bit about their background and why they're running, and I'll start with you, Dave.
Sure. Well, I was born and raised in Rochester, graduated from Franklin High School, and my family is here to stay, and I'm not going anywhere. I'm proud of the city, but I see things happening that I would like. I'd like there to be more equity, just in the way we do business here, the way our resources are shared, and the only way to change that is to get involved, and that's why I'm running again.
Mm-hmm. What's the most important issue to you, Dave, in this campaign?
Poverty. Mm-hmm. I assume we'll go on.
Poverty.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I have tons. We can talk about that for a while down the road, but that's my main issue.
Okay, great. Alex, same question. Tell us a little bit. You've run for office
a couple times.
Yes, most recently for mayor.
Yep.
And now you're running for city council. Why city council?
Well, it was what's up this time. I'm very involved in city government. I have recently I've been on the board of the Oasis School, which trains people without a high school education to get jobs. I've been involved in police accountability, all sorts of issues, and most of these things seem like they could be solved by city government if they cared to. And yet, it seems we spend a lot of time fighting for the things that we need or want, and I continue to watch neighborhoods unable to control development in their area, and even things as simple as which direction the streets go. And it just seems that we have less voice in the city than we've had before, and things are going worse than they have.
Mm-hmm. The most important issue for you?
Poverty's been increasing 0.5 percentage point a year for the last 20 years, and somehow that doesn't seem to be a crisis with anyone.
We will definitely discuss poverty this hour. I know both of the other candidates have their concerns about that as well. Chris Eades, we'll turn to you now. Why are you running? Why council? Tell us a little bit about your background as well.
All right. Well, I was born in the city of Rochester, and I came back here after college and have lived here for the past 20 years. I work in information technology and have for 15 years. As to why I'm running, it's not, like Alex, it's not really my first rodeo. I've run for office before. And I think, you know, since you're going to ask me anyway, what I think is the most important issue or biggest problem that we're facing, I'm going to say corporate welfare. Obviously, that has some relation to poverty because we're basically redistributing money from the poor to the rich when we do that. But it has, you know, lots of other corrosive effects. I mean, not just on the local level. For instance, on the state level, we had something like $2 billion to give to Amazon, and we have plenty of roads and bridges that need repairing here. It's a problem all over, right? But, you know, we have to fight it at the local level and work our way upwards. It's, you know, basically the public treasury is being looted, right? We have You know, we have millions of dollars to give to people that are already sitting on a stack of money, and that money comes from, you know, ordinary small business owners and residents.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Chris. Also joining us today, Marcus Williams. He's the Republican candidate in the South District. Welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me today.
Tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, Marcus, and why you've decided to run for council.
Well, my name is Marcus C. Williams. And I've actually lived in the South District my whole life. I lived in all three legislative districts in my district, so the 24th, the 25th, and the 27th. I went to all public schools in my district, and I just love my district. I'm also an entrepreneur who has a business in my district. So I care a lot about my district. I care a lot about our communities in our district, and we're underserved. It's a fact, and it's sad. We need a lot of things, and I get emotional about it. It's very important to me. Basically, to sum it up, we don't have adequate representation in our city government. Our city officials do not come out and see what we need in our communities. They don't come out and do things unless something crazy happens and it's on the TV. Unless it's something that can get a hot spot at 7 o'clock on the news, nobody wants to be there. They don't come out and see us. They don't care about what our infrastructure has issues with. They don't care about our children or any programs that we have for them. They don't care about any of our needs. Like, broadband is a serious issue in my community. A lot of people don't have access to adequate internet speeds. And it's a problem when you're trying to run a business or when you're going to school and you're trying to learn. And it's just, we need so much that has been overlooked because people have been concentrated on high-cost development and moving people from the suburbs into the city instead of concentrating on home ownership in the city, which can only be fostered by encouraging our youth to go into business development and entrepreneurship and to get them to stay here, because right now we have a very large graying of our tax bracket, so there's less money to go around everywhere.
What's the biggest issue facing council that you see in Rochester?
That's a toughie. But I'd say, honestly, community engagement. Okay, there's not enough community engagement. They don't come out to the community to see what they need. When they do come, it's not very often. And unfortunately, the community doesn't feel like they have a voice, even if that's not accurate. You know, because a lot of times the people on council say, oh, well, we're not a rubber stamp for the mayor. But when I go out in the community kind of feels that way. And that's something that needs to be addressed.
I have a number of issues I'd like to ask all of you about this hour. We'll go around the table and talk about those, but we're also taking questions from our listeners. And here is one coming in from a listener who has a question for Marcus. He says, Marcus is a young Black man in an urban area running as a Republican. That's a bit unusual. What drew Marcus to the Republican Party platform?
Okay. Well, the Republicans actually, interestingly enough, basically preach the tenets of what most Black parents teach their children. They teach, keep the government out of your business. They teach, make sure that you take care of your family first. They also make sure that you take care of your community. And Republicans are about local things, not so much the national scale. And people confuse that when they see politicians on the national scheme of things, you know. So,
do you support President Trump?
I support the office of the president. I have concerns about him with national security, but I do like quite a bit of the policies that he has, but not all of them. Let me be clear there.
Okay. Do you think that there are many people across the nation who would call the president racist? Do you think the president is racist?
No, he's not racist, to be honest. He actually isn't racist for one simple reason. He's all about himself, but he's always, being a New Yorker, we already knew that. We knew that for years. He preaches me, 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 me. It's not like he cares about white people. I hate to say it like that, but he doesn't. You know, they even had, Richard Spencer get on the TV and say that he doesn't care about white nationalists. He's trying to trick them because he cares about himself and emboldening his moves and his desires and fattening his pocket, which isn't bad because we can see where he's coming from at that point and we know how to take him and address it.
Okay. Let's address some of those issues that I mentioned previously. We'll start with the school board discussion, the school district discussion. Last week, a state Supreme Court judge ruled that Mayor Lovely Warren's referendum regarding a state takeover of the city school district was illegal. So voters will not see that on the ballot in November. I'll start with you, Chris. Did you support the referendum?
No. No, for many reasons. I was against, you know, mayoral control when it was Robert Duffy. And, you know, I'm against that now that it's Lovely Warren. Although it's interesting to see that some of the same people that opposed it with Duffy are now supporting it with Lovely Warren, which suggests that it may not be principle that they're operating under here. But, you know, I don't support a referendum that does something that the city is not legally able to do. I mean, it's always disappointing to see, you know, when any organ of government does something it's not legally allowed to do. And, you know, definitely, if I was on the city council, you know, I would make sure before going ahead with something unusual like this that we had researched it and, you know, would know whether it's actually something that we can do.
How do you feel about a possible state takeover?
You know, I think, and I have some knowledge about school board issues. I ran for school board twice in 2007 and 2009. I don't really see that a state takeover would do much. I mean, actually, in New York State, local school boards don't have a lot of control. A lot of what they do and what they have to spend money on is mandated by the state. And that lack of flexibility, I think, is a cause of a lot of problems. So I don't think that having the state take it over directly really materially changes a lot of the dynamics that are causing issues with the school district. So I don't see it as much of an improvement.
Mm-hmm. Alex, did you support the referendum?
No. I can't believe people think that fighting over who controls the school district will help the children. And I think anyone who does try to fight over solely over control is really not interested in the children at all. And there are so many things that the mayor and the city could have done, starting with, you know, the MOE. They've given the school district the same amount of money since 2005 that they gave this year. And they have raised the taxes that they collect overall by 25%, but given no additional money to the schools, and they don't think they're the problem. And they've cut library hours, recreation hours, after school programs, Pathways to Peace, which deals with the gang issue, and all of these cuts have hurt schools. And if they wanted to do something, there were lots of choices they could have started with, all of which I intend to push for.
What's your number one first step? What's the number one fix in your mind?
The number one fix? Well, I think we can start by increasing the MOE at least some, maybe a 2% a year, so it keeps up with inflation rate is, at least increase it by that amount so that they can cover increased costs.
Okay. Dave, same question. Did you support the referendum?
Absolutely not. The folks who I've been reading on social media who say that this was an opportunity for parents to voice their opinion about the school board. Look, an illegal referendum was not the way to do it, especially if it were to go through and it were to pass, it wasn't going to really do anything. If parents want to voice their opinion, they are able to go to the school board every month. They're able to call the show. They're able to write letters to the editor. There are many, many ways for them to voice their opinion other than an expensive, illegal referendum. So what can we do about the school district and what can city council and the mayor's office do? Well, both Chris and Alex started to touch on it. As a teacher, I can tell you when my students come in and they haven't eaten, that's a problem. That's something that city council and city government can do something about. If there's parents that don't have jobs or have too many jobs that aren't paying enough, that's something city council and the mayor can do that actually help our kids. Some of us last night were talking about rate hikes for RG&E. The prices go up for that. That's going to affect our kids' home life. That's going to affect what they do in school. They could be working on stuff like that, like creating a public utility. Again, I'm back to when my one-word answer is my most important thing is about poverty. That will affect schools directly. That's something that the city government should be doing to take care of. And that will also affect climate change and almost every other thing we're going to talk about today. Poverty will have an effect on that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Marcus, same question. Did you support the referendum?
Absolutely not. It's like so many other things with city politics where they're gaming us. They're really playing our society and our communities, trying to get us to think that something is going to do anything at all when really it has no effect on what's going on. And that's really disappointing to see that continually happen, especially when they send out mailers and stuff like that advocating or pushing a certain point of view when it should be something that is not directly partisan in nature. And it should also be something that actually informs the people in our communities of exactly how a referendum per se would actually impact them if it were to pass or if it were to fail, and would that really have an impact on what the people actually want. Now, as far as schooling goes and everything and the budget and stuff, it's miserable. Right now, what we have going on in the, let's say, the state, they want to make it so that it's legal for kids to vote at 16 years old. Okay, hear that. 16 years old, but they're still in school until 18. When you go through middle school, you go through high school, a lot of kids are like, I don't even understand why I should come to school. It all seems very redundant. Over and over again, we're repeating the same cycle of setting the bar too low for our children. We coddle them too much, and we don't focus on what they believe is valuable. And that's actually being able to go out in the workforce and actually work in the real world. I mean, we have very little things about civics or participation in government or home and economics where you learn how to balance a checkbook and anything. Most people in my district, a very large portion of them, are either underbanked or have no bank at all. And that's an important thing that affects, like everybody else is talking about, poverty is a big thing. But really, we set our children up for a fall when we expect too little of them. And like, money isn't the big issue. It's really the educational curriculum and the way that it's implemented. We expect less of them, and we expect them to learn things from 30, 40 years ago that to them, they don't see any point in today. Why are you locking up children's cell phones when that's their main tool for learning and communicating nowadays? Why aren't we working to put that into all of the exercises that we do in our classes? And this is actually something I spoke with the superintendent about, and he said that he's working on some programs for that to incorporate things like that. Schooling is very important, but I believe we're going about it in the wrong way.
Okay, we'll have the superintendent, the new superintendent, Terry Dade, on this program next week. I believe it's the 15th, so you can hear from him directly, and we can, of course, feed any questions from our candidates and our listeners to him and possibly play parts of this conversation. Let's turn to police accountability now. The City Council passed Police Accountability Board legislation in May. That will be a referendum on the ballot in November. Alex, we'll start with you this time. Do you support the legislation that Council passed in May?
Yes. It could have been better. There were a number of changes that could have been made that would have made it a stronger piece of legislation. But overall, and I've been working on this issue for 20 years, overall, this is good. And I hope everyone goes out and votes yes on the referendum.
When you say that it could be stronger, what would you like to see?
At the moment, it's set up so that there will be five people appointed by the city government and four people appointed from the public.
So four from city council, one by the mayor, four from the public.
And I would like to see the public have a majority in this. And also, I believe there's going to be a lot more work than they think. And I think that being a lot of the work is going to be done by panels of three of these 11 people. I think, these nine people. I don't think there's enough. You know, I just think that the workload is going to be very high for a volunteer board. And I think that they really should have made it larger and let the workload be spread out more among these committees, basically, of three people, which I think would have made it more effective.
Okay. Dave?
Yeah, like Alex, I've been a member of the Police Accountability Board Alliance for years, and in my campaign, I'm stumping for this referendum, and I'm hoping that people vote for it. If there are some weaknesses to it that were changed as the process went along, but if something's not working out, it is set up so that we can go back and change the structure of the PAB so that we can close any loopholes or any problems there. I definitely for this. It's something that's desperately needed in the city.
Are there any changes that you think would make it stronger? Is there anything you'd want to see removed right now if it were up to you?
Well, even with the numbers, Alex, I mean, we both agree. We both know that in the end, city council has to approve everybody no matter who nominates them. So really, it is going to be relatively city controlled. So I would like to see some kind of way that the public has a little bit more authority with that. But again, that's something we can change down the line if we're finding that the makeup, even with the four public nominations, even if that's not working out well, we can always go back and change it. It's a really huge step. Mm-hmm. So I'm definitely for this.
Marcus, Police Accountability Board, do you support the legislation that council passed in May?
I do, but I am concerned that they're using it for political gain. Just to make them seem like that's something that they want and not taking a lot of things into account. I have a lot of concerns about it. One, that it doesn't necessarily have enough teeth. And to add more teeth to that, I believe it should be coupled with some actual municipal legislation that regards directly to police. So, like, a lot of people are concerned that the police avoid jail time and crimes that are actually found by judges of them to be guilty of. But the only way to change that is to say, like, listen, okay, this is wrong. This is illegal in our municipality for police. Say, for instance, one common sense thing that should be there is if somebody is already restrained, physically restrained, and they are not resisting and you continue to bludgeon them and beat them, that should be illegal. You should be able to hold somebody accountable for that legally. But there is not necessarily anything to do that. People say, well, there's laws against this and that and assault and things like that. But aren't you saying that these laws don't seem to apply to the police? Would, yeah.
Alex, I see you reacting.
Yeah.
So
well,
We just indicted an officer here in Rochester who did.
Out of how many? Out of how many times do we have this
You're
happen?
Right, Marcus, but this it's not because we don't have the laws. It's because district attorney and the people in the system won't use it. So we don't need new laws.
In fact, until we got the body cameras, we had very little possibility of getting any conviction. And the Sipple case shows how important the body cameras are to actually be able to hold the officers accountable legally. Mm-hmm. And without the body camera, Sipple would have walked. It wouldn't have even been charged, and Christopher Pate would have gone to jail. And the laws are there. It's just the ability to enforce them, improve them, has been lacking.
And the will.
And the will. And we now have some good tools. The Police Accountability Board will be able to investigate and recommend for the DA to investigate and prosecute, and the laws, to get the laws actually enforced. This is our opportunity. We now have the tools to do it, and the laws exist, and I know that because Sipple was indicted.
Alex, you seem to say as though I don't believe that the body cameras are a good idea or that what's going on isn't positive, and that's not what I'm saying at all. I'm saying that other measures need to be in place, too. Are you saying that you would be against legislation that says that if somebody is restrained and you continue to beat on them, that
that's
you
should...
It's not... No, but see, that's what he's implying. He's implying that what I'm saying makes no sense when there is legitimacy to what I am saying.
There are already laws against that. Also, a local law would run into state laws, which already cover this, and the state laws would take precedence, so it wouldn't even matter if you mm-hmm. made stricter laws. So... What you're suggesting...
No, I'm saying that there need to be definitions put out there in law of what is legal and what is not as part of what is additionally being applied.
It's already out there.
Yeah.
It's not enough.
It's already out there. And
you're also one of the ones who has been fighting for the Police Accountability Board, saying that not enough has been done on these laws. Now you're putting more people out there, and they're supposed to be able to look over the people who already seem to have... abundance of power and don't feel that they're within the constraints of the law, you think that they're going to continuously be executed on just because we've got a police accountability board?
No, I think that the combination of the police accountability board, the body cameras, and a lot of sunlight and attention thrown to this issue is going to allow to make prosecution of officers more likely when they step out of bounds.
Mm-hmm. And the work to get 50A taken right. care of.
And
at the
I
state
think
level.
The officers, knowing they could be prosecuted, will act better.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And do you think I'm against that?
No, I don't.
No.
Oh, okay. I don't think you're against that. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that I think the laws we currently have are sufficient. And what we need is we need to enforce those laws. And I've been working to make tools that will do that so that we can finally get to it.
But the idea in commonplace is that people think that the police feel that they're above the law. So there will be laws that specifically apply to them. And that it would be why.
But there are.
Okay, let's put a pin in this for one moment so we can let Chris jump in. And you can weigh in as well, Chris. So your thoughts on the Police Accountability Board. As it stands now, based on what council passed in May, do you support it?
Yes. As Alex alluded to, it could be better. But I think it's a reasonable political compromise that we can work with. I do think that there are some similarities in the dynamic here, and also what I was talking about before with corporate welfare, and that there are certain people that the city favors and there are certain people the city does not favor. And the exact way that this mechanism works itself out may be a little bit different here with the police versus, you know, what the city council does with corporate welfare. But we see some of the same like social and political dynamics behind it. And I would like to mention a couple of other things on the same subject. Recently in a Syracuse case, a judge ruled that police disciplinary procedures cannot be part of collective bargaining. So this idea that the police department can negotiate themselves an immunity from being fired or disciplined is now off the table, and I'd like to see where we can go with that. And also one of the things that I'm proposing is to make the office of the police chief an elected office, like the county sheriff, which I think would also go a long way towards, you know, improving the police accountability.
Okay. So I don't want to draw away from the conversation that Alex and Marcus were just having. Now, feel free, David and Chris, to weigh in. So just to line things up here, Alex, you're saying there are laws already in place. Marcus, you're saying you want to see stronger laws.
Yes.
Do you both agree that those laws are difficult to enforce? Do we need more strength in enforcing those laws?
Yes.
And the Police Accountability Board is one step in the right direction.
Okay. We have a few listeners who want to weigh in on this issue, and we'll take their calls in just a moment. But one more question for all of you. Some members of the community, specifically former law enforcement officers, are disappointed that the voice of law enforcement is not on the board. They would like to see that. And one particular person that I'm thinking of, who is a former candidate for city council, said that if a police officer, a former police officer, I should say, is not on the board, there may be some feelings of mistrust between police and the community. How do you all feel about that? Chris, we'll start with you.
Well, I mean, I think we need to realize that there's already mistrust between the police and the community, and it's really not the community that's responsible for that, you know, except insofar as we've lacked the political will to rein in, you know, misconduct by the police department. So I think, you know, while I can see the point in that, I also think that really the police department is, they're the ones that have had the power. They're the ones that have misused the power. So they're the ones that are going to have to compromise a little bit more on this issue than the community.
Okay, Dave?
Well, I can guess who this was who said that, but I would also question if this person actually read the legislation. The members of the Police Accountability Board, the people who will be doing the work, have, if not the chief of police, then a designated member of the police department at their disposal to ask questions about procedure and policy. The PAB can also use the city's lawyers, or they have the ability to hire outside counsel for advice as well. So there's really not going to be a problem in terms of civilians on the Police Accountability Board not understanding how the police work or how the laws work. That's not going to be an issue. And then going back to, yeah, there is mistrust, and having a police member on the former, any connection to a police department on the board is going to bring community distrust of the PAB, and that's going to prohibit a lot of folks bringing their issues to them. So it you're almost sabotaging it if you do that.
Okay. Marcus, what are your thoughts on that issue?
I think that it's a real serious issue in and of itself, because as I said, there is a lot of distrust between the police and the community and the community and the police. And it's from years of neglect and people feeling like their voices are not heard and that we're underrepresented on the police force. There are a lot of issues with the police force hiring practices that I hear in our community. And I've spoke to some people in the police department and they believe that it can be improved. And that's really probably one of the places that we need to be looking at making a change as well. I do believe that there should be something. Like, I don't have the answers for everything, and I'd like to look more into it when I'm elected, but I do believe that there should be some other way as well to have some police liaison alternative. Like, I don't want to say liaison, but maybe a retired person that the community respects that's from law enforcement on the board. I don't know if that person exists, but maybe we could find somebody.
Okay, yeah. Alex?
Boy, I remember talking with people about this as it was being floated around in the debate, as we were trying to negotiate to get to the legislation we currently have. And one of the interesting things is it always was a retired officer on the board. And, you know, what are there, 17 Rochester police officers who live in the city of Rochester out of 900, out of 720? I mean, how many of them move out when they retire? A number of them. The number of retired police officers is so small, it's unlikely you'd be able to find someone anyways. And if you said they couldn't be an RPD officer but had to be from another police thing, I'd think the number goes down to zero. I think this is just impossible. And one of the things that we've been seeing is we have been seeing we have been seeing the public over time has lost faith in even the ability to complain about officers. And you see this at our current CRB board and that the complaints started going down. In 2017 and 18, they went up. And they went up because body cameras all of a sudden started to actually get some answers. And I think this is the sort of trust we can build upon. And I think anything that may scare the public away, like putting a police officer on the board, particularly at the moment, I think would be detrimental to our efforts to rein in our police department.
Well, it turns out we could do a whole hour on police accountability. That's all, yeah. And there are other issues we need to talk about, but I do want to get some listener feedback on this particular issue before we take our break. So up first on the phones is John in Rochester. Go ahead, John.
Good afternoon, guys. This is all to you. You guys got to look outside the box a little bit. You know, the people, the police might just say, go ahead, do what you got to do, and walk away now. Who's going to make the decision then?
Facts.
I mean it seriously. You got to think of these other things. There's a lot of things that could happen that just because you got an accountability board says this, if they walk away, what are you going to do? You can't say nothing. You can't tell them nothing. You can't fire them. You can't have them arrested.
Where's
what are you
going to
do? You got to think of these things.
I'm not quite.
I have to admit, I'm confused by the question or comment, John.
I'm saying that if you guys are going to do this accountability board, and two police go to see a guy, and they're going to have him arrested. Okay, something starts to go wrong. They turn around, get right back in their car, and take off. They don't even bother. Now, what are you going to do? What are you going to do to the cops then? Oh, well, you should have did this. You should no. No. The accountability board says, well, if you do this, we're going to have you arrested. So they say, goodbye. We're walking away. Let the guy do what he wants to do. Let the woman do what she wants to do. And there's more crime. Then what are you going to do?
Okay. Go ahead, Alex.
Got an idea?
John, this has been something that's been brought up a number of times, that if we actually try to provide some supervision and accountability to police, they will do their job somehow worse. And the reason for the accountability board is some of the officers are doing their job poorly. So what we're trying to do is get some level of supervision. And if they, in almost all cases, there will be some record of the stop. There'll be some record of a call for service. If there's a second officer there, they had to have been dispatched. If the officer stopped and got out of the car, he had to call it in. So there's plenty of records. And then if they walk away, that makes it something that you can enforce. And if they are willfully refusing to do their job, you fire them.
Yeah.
It's right.
You get someone else.
Right. You'll find someone else. It's a good paying job. It does have its problems.
Nobody wants to be a police officer
difficult.
In my community.
It is difficult, but there are people who will fill this job. They may not be from Marcus's community, but they should be, because that's the people we need to be on the force. And if we can only, if they refuse to do their job, there's going to be mass firings. That's all there is.
Okay, related
how you,
to...
How can you fire a policeman if he doesn't, if he's not going to get involved with the crime that's going to happen? Suppose he, like, suppose the person you just talked about, the one that got beat up.
Yeah, John, I got to let you go just because we have a lot of questions on this issue, but related to the firing issue, up next is Kent in Fairport. Go ahead, Kent.
Hi, thanks. And just real quick, I appreciate all you guys' time for being on the show. So this is kind of primarily focused on officer-involved fatalities. The reality is that between use of force doctrine and the rules of engagement, most police-involved fatalities are legally defensible. Whether they're reprehensible or not, all the cops have to do is feel for their life, and they're allowed to use lethal force. And as much as the moral victory of having prosecutions would be wonderful, and I totally understand that sentiment, I'm a little more wondering if there's anything you see that could be done where when police officers, whether it's legally defensible or not, are involved in a fatality that clearly shows they made poor decisions, that we can somehow start cycling these officers out, get them fired for not making good decisions, and get competent officers who are not, you know, gun shy and going to lethal force as their first recourse of action.
Okay, thanks, Kent. I'll turn to our panelists. Marcus, I know you wanted to jump in.
Yes. He brings up a very important point, and that's kind of where I was going with the legislation. We need a lot of retraining, you know. We need new considerations for the time in which we are in. And a lot of officers have received the same training that they've received for decades. And right now, with the sentiments that are in the community and their lack of cooperation or willingness of cooperation with the police, it's very understandable. And that's one of the reasons why I believe certain things should be outlined in law, saying that certain things are illegal and that more additional steps can be taken.
Okay, thanks, Dave.
Yeah, well, as part of the legislation, there's a disciplinary matrix that has to get developed between both the police and the PAB. And once that's put into place, when this legislation passes, if the referendum passes, the PAB doesn't, like, start its existence the next day.
Right.
So there's people who have to get nominated to the board, there's training, and then this disciplinary matrix gets developed. And once that happens, also within the legislation is the ability for the PAB to recommend changes to police training. So that actually is part of the legislation and in theory is going to take care of that. And if it doesn't do a good job, like I said before, we can go back and close loopholes.
Okay, we've got to move on because
yes.
We have a lot of issues, but thank you all for addressing those questions. Kent, thank you for the call. We're going to take our short break. When we come back, we're going to try to bring in as much feedback as possible, cover as many issues as possible with our guests, Alex White, Chris Eads, Dave Sutliff-Adius, and Marcus Williams, all running for Rochester City Council. So short break, more with the candidates next. I'm Megan Mack. Thursday on The Next Connections, a conversation about tipping etiquette. When you tip at a restaurant, do you get nervous? Do you feel guilty? Are you not sure how much to tip? What determines your personal rules for tipping etiquette? Well, millennials have new views on this subject, as reported by the Washington Post. We'll talk about those and about tipping etiquette in Rochester. That's Thursday. Talk to you then. This is Connections. I'm Megan Mack, sitting in for Evan Dawson. Today, we're talking to candidates for Rochester City Council. Listeners, I know you still have questions about police accountability. We're moving on to a few different issues, but if you'd like to hang on the line, we can try to address them later in the program. Or you can, of course, email the candidates and ask them questions specifically if you'd like. So let's just go around the room. I'll have each of you tell our listeners where they can find you. Chris Eads.
Okay. Well, the easiest thing to do is to go to my website. It's www.vote-for-chris.net. There's a contact form there where you can get in touch with me. I also have a Facebook page, which is, you know, www.facebook.com/ChrisEadsForCouncil. And you can also contact me that way. I'm glad to answer anyone's questions. And of course, as a third party candidate, always need more volunteers. So if you like what you hear, please contact me and let me know if you want to help.
Great. Alex.
I'm at alexwhite4rochester at gmail.com. I'm also Alex White on Facebook, Alex White for City Council on Facebook, and you can even call me at 281-5953.
Marcus.
I can be reached at, the best way actually would be to reach me on Facebook. Marcus C. Williams for South District City Council. You type Marcus C. Williams, it'll pop up right there. Message me. I'm very responsive. I can also be contacted on my website at marcus4rochester.com. I do have an email. You can email me at marcuscwilliamscampaign@gmail.com.
Great. And Dave?
My handle for just about everything is Dave for Change. Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter is Dave for Change. My website's daveforchange.org. My email is dave@daveforchange.org. Pretty simple.
Great. Okay, we're going to try to move through as many issues as effectively as possible. I won't say quickly because I don't want to cut anyone off if we have a discussion. But let's start with Parcel 5. A lot of conversations happening in our community now about the future. I shouldn't say now, over the last several years, about the future of this site. We're sort of back to square one. I'll start with you, Dave, this time. What would you like to see happening at Parcel 5?
I would like to see, well, okay, first I'll really quickly, I will do what how I'd like to see it happen, and then I'll just give my own personal preference. Not necessarily what I would, you know, go to the mat for when I'm elected, but I would like to see the community have a say, not something like the highest bidder, the developer, gets to decide what goes in there. Personally, I would like to see green space, maybe even consider a downtown orchard, something that will do a lot of different things, including tackle climate change, improve our everyday life, and actually improve the way downtown looks a little bit.
Okay. Marcus.
I am also for community input on there. Actually, I've been pushing for updated ways to actually participate in government by being able to use your cell phone and contact and take polls on anything that is over a few $100,000 worth of city investment. I believe that's very important, and we need to develop a new way for our citizens to communicate their ideas. I would love to see some green space there, especially if it's enclosed, and that way we can have access to it all year round.
Okay, great. Chris?
I would also like to see public input, but I'd like to make a distinction in that I'd like to see that come from residents who live downtown. I live downtown on Water Street, and one thing I've noticed is there's no neighborhood association for downtown. Like, the city is very careful to get to cultivate local groups and get their input for every other neighborhood, but downtown seems to exist for the rest of the city, and nobody really asks the residents there what they want. So I would like to see public input, but I would like to see that come from people who live in the neighborhood that is downtown. And I, personally would like to see some green space. And actually, while I'm on this topic, I would like to point out that if you live downtown and you think that it should get more representation, the census is taking place in 2020, and the people that you elect to the city council this year will be there to redraw the districts. So if you, what I would like to see is downtown be all part of one district instead of divided up so that we actually have a little more influence.
Okay. Alex, what would you like to see at Parcel 5?
I'd like to see the city not spend money on it. We have showered that area with cash and tax breaks and all sorts of public inducements. And at the moment, we have, throwing that in, we have 19 square acres of space in the downtown, in the old inner loop area, we have 19 acres of undeveloped land. So the demand for doing something is pretty small. So what I would like to see is something that probably green space, but something that is inexpensive to do and reserves the property in case at some point demand develops.
Okay. Moving on to a different issue that several of you brought up before the program began, and that's dynamic staffing or brownouts in the fire department locally. We've done an entire show on this issue, and for our listeners, earlier this summer, the city implemented what it's calling dynamic staffing. Some are calling it brownouts for local firehouses. The policy closes one firehouse during the evening and overnight hours and shifts firefighters in that specific location to another firehouse nearby. The city implemented that policy to save money in the budget. I'll just go around the room and ask each of you, do you support dynamic staffing? Alex?
No. Do you want more?
Yes.
Okay. Let me go with what the craziest thing about this is. The mayor has said in the budget they put that this was going to save $292,200. Then the mayor came out and said it would save $863,000. Then the mayor said it would save $1.2 million. Then the mayor said it would save over $1 million. Then the mayor said it would save $1.3 million. This reminded me a little of McCarthy with his number of card-carrying communists in the State Department. Okay? The official number is the number she put in the budget. That amount of money is tiny. It's almost a rounding error in the city budget. So to punish people and to put people's lives at risk for $292,000 seems like incompetent government. And that money could have been found by the mayor not increasing her staff by two people like she did. And I can't imagine that those two people are going to have a greater impact than fully funding the fire department was.
The city, if they were here, would say that this policy is not going to increase response times, or response times will not be affected by the policy.
Well, that's not what the official scoring of this said. In the study that they did, they said that it would increase the response time in affected areas by at least 18 seconds. And when every second counts, you know, when you divide that out among the entire city, this is only for the affected area. That 18 seconds can actually be a matter of life and death. And it seems, you know, they did a whole study on this, and the study said that the study is the place that they got this idea from, and it suggested that they could do this. It said they could, if they rearranged the location of the fire departments, they would not actually decrease service because they could reduce by one fire station at least and still cover the whole city with the same rate they do. But they can't do it under the current thing, and there would be an increased response time. And that's from the study the city did. So I don't know where they're getting their number, but like the mayor's number of savings, it seems made up.
Yeah.
Okay. Marcus?
I think it's a little bit ludicrous. I have to be honest. Yesterday, we saw how the Family Dollar roof collapsed and the fire department responded to that. Like, we have structural engineers and all types of people, first responders, hazardous materials professionals that are involved with the fire department. We don't know what we're really giving up for this small amount of change, which really could be gotten by if they're actually charging the taxes to these luxury developments that they keep giving tax breaks for. That's another big thing for me. That's a no-no. I'm not about this lofty luxury development getting subsidized by the city. If you have enough money to build luxury development, you don't need our corporate welfare. That's a fact.
I think everyone on this panel, based on your platforms, will probably agree with that.
Well, I did the research on that.
I know you
did. So, you know, that was my issue, and I've done all the research on it. So,
speaking to a lot of firemen, so let me give a brief example.
Brief, because we're running out of time, and I have to let Dave and Chris jump in.
Real quick, the month before last, I had a gas emergency at my apartment. The fire department came very expeditiously. Come to find out, it was a massive gas leak, and they had to shut off the gas main. Thank for that, we were saved, and nobody died. That could have been really serious.
Okay, Dave.
It's a scam, and it's funny. I haven't heard about police overtime being cut. I haven't heard of any other overtime from any other departments in the city being cut, just the fire department. It's obviously a power play with the firefighters union. And if you're telling me, I don't care what figure she wants to use today, if you're telling me you don't have that money in the cash capital fund or you can't even bond for it like we do for a lot of this corporate welfare, but you're picking the fire department to play around with, it's negligent.
Chris Eads.
Yeah, I'm going to echo a lot of what was said here. I mean, basically, the problem is our priorities. I mean, we're doing things like cutting the hours for recreation centers and libraries, which, you know, poor people use more than the well-to-do. And we even tried to cut library hours beyond what we presently have, and the city had to stop because it's actually in violation of state law to reduce them beyond a certain point. And now we're turning to the fire department, which is, if anything, is even more of a basic service. So, I mean, I feel that if we can come up with about $30 to $40 million in corporate welfare, which is about what we do every year, we can come up with, you know, $292,000 or whatever the figure is for the fire department and all of these other priorities. I mean, it's just symptomatic of the, you know, what I mentioned in my opening comments, which is that our priorities are just backwards and they serve the well-to-do instead of the common person.
We're down to our last minute, and so what I'll do is I'll go around the table. I would like to know from each of you, as you're knocking on doors, as you're walking around your districts, talking to voters, what is the number one issue on their minds that you're hearing about? Chris?
Well, it depends on where I am. I think in the neighborhoods, you know, to the north of where I live downtown, a police accountability is definitely a thing because that's where the police tend to have a lot of their negative encounters. More downtown, I think people are more concerned with small businesses and the kind of like nickel and diming that the city does in terms of permits and if you're just trying to improve your property. But you know, and I'll just, because I want to keep hitting on this theme, it's all part of the same thing where the city is favoring, you know, the well-to-do large corporations versus small businesses, you know, at the expense of, you know, the people they should be serving.
Okay. Number one issue, Alex, that you're hearing?
People are most concerned about the fact that their voice is not being heard. And development issues and neighborhood issues, they're not being heard, and they want a voice, and I'd give it to them.
Marcus, 10 seconds. Number one issue.
Number one issue is actually the encouraging our youth to actually stay in our city so that we can have advanced development actually happen in our city from our residents.
And Dave.
City government's not listening to them.
All right. I'd like to thank all of the guests for joining me today. You can find them all online. Marcus Williams, Dave Sutliff-Adius, Chris Eads, and Alex White, all running for city council. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for listening today. My thanks to Gary Putup on phones, Rob Braden, our excellent engineer, as always. I'm Megan Mack, sitting in for Evan Dawson this week. Thanks for listening to Member Supported Public Radio.